Kindness is one of the fruit of the spirit, we're told in the New Testament. But they're also nursing virtues, and they're ones that have shaped Sarah, I think, in terms of her personal character. She has washed the feet of probably literally thousands of people in her nursing ministry, and she adopts that as a metaphor for what it means to be a Christian leader.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. Let's start off with a little history lesson today. Do you know who the Archbishop of Canterbury is, or what the Archbishop of Canterbury is? Who, what? The Archbishop of Canterbury is the ceremonial head of the Anglican Communion, so the representative person of the Anglican Communion worldwide. And this person is also the primate, or the head bishop, of the Church of England. Let's go back several centuries ago to the 6th century, to the first Archbishop of Canterbury. This was a guy named Augustine of Canterbury, and he was sent by Pope Gregory on a mission to re-evangelize Britain after the first century wave of Christianity that came in with the Roman slaves, the Anglo-Saxons, had returned to their pagan ways. You can read Augustine's story, his adventures in Britain, in the ecclesiastical history of the English people by the Venerable Bede. And this book includes letters that Augustine wrote to Pope Gregory, asking for pastoral advice on things like when British women should be allowed to receive the Eucharist. Gregory's resounding answer was, yes, please do that as often as you do it for the men. Yes, please. I wonder if Pope Gregory or Augustine could have imagined a day when Augustine's successor would be a British woman. In case you haven't heard, Anglicans have made world news for electing the first woman to serve as the Archbishop of Canterbury, former Bishop of London, the Most Reverend Sarah Mullally. She is the 106th ABC, Archbishop of Canterbury. I'll just say ABC, make my job a little easier. Archbishop Sarah is brand new to the role of ABC and coming in at a time of many tensions and possible changes within the Anglican Communion, including what the role of the ABC should actually be and what shape the church might take under the continued pressures of disagreement over what it means to be faithful to the gospel today. So, who is Archbishop Sarah Mullally? And what might we expect from her ministry? Our editor-in-chief, the Reverend Dr. Mark Michael, sat down with Dr. Andrew Atherston, who is that you ask? Well, he is someone who has just published the definitive biography of Archbishop Sarah called, very appropriately, Archbishop Sarah Mullally, a biography. And they will talk about why she was the dark horse of the ABC race that the bookies didn't initially bet on, why Andrew calls her a trailblazer and a pioneer, how 20 years in a Southside evangelical church and a 20-year career as a nurse shape her leadership, what we can learn from a collection of her parish sermons, and how we might anticipate her role in the Anglican Communion's approach to euthanasia, same-sex marriage, and other divisive issues. Andrew is professor of modern Anglicanism at the University of Oxford and tutorial fellow and Latimer Research Fellow at Wycliffe Hall, Oxford. He's a prolific writer and also the biographer of the former ABC, Justin Welby. A quick note, Mark and Andrew bring up some issues in the Anglican Communion that you might not have heard of, but they're good about defining the terms as they go. That being said, I did want to just add a quick note about something called the Living in Love and Faith process that they bring up. If you don't know what that is, it's a big research and conversation project set up in the Church of England for the purpose of corporate listening and discernment around human sexuality. Basically, are we listening well to one another, and what should we do about what we hear? I'll include a link to the official page in the show notes. Now, I know, in the immortal words of Michael Jackson, ABC is easy as 1, 2, 3, but really, Michael, I'm sorry, it's not. Archbishop of Canterbury is a tough gig. We all need to be praying for Archbishop Sarah, for real. But how might her past help specially nurture the Anglican Communion's present and future? We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Andrew, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, hello, Mark. It's lovely to be on the show, so thank you for having me along.
Now, as I understand it, you committed to write this book months before the new Archbishop of Canterbury was announced last October, and you managed to write this solidly researched 200-page book that's being released now in mid-March. I spoke with you last September, and you said then you were doing a little reading based on your best guesses of who would become the Archbishop. So my first question is, did you guess right? Did you think it would be Sarah Mullally?
My guesses were completely wrong in terms of my predictions for who would be the new Archbishop. There were many other runners and riders, and I was getting ready, purchasing books by them and downloading their PhD theses and those sorts of things. I was getting all primed. But I'd done no research on Sarah Mullally until the day that she was announced.
So she was a classic dark horse in the race.
Well, a sort of appointment that when she is announced, you say, well, yes, that's so obvious. But I suppose she wasn't being primed in the bookies' numbers. She certainly wasn't up near the list, partly because of her age. So she is 63. She turned 64 the day after her installation. That gives her only 6 years at the most as Archbishop of Canterbury, because in the Church of England, we have mandatory retirement at 70. So most people were looking at someone maybe in their late 50s. As you say, Sarah was the dark horse who came up on the inside.
Tell our listeners a little bit about your background, how you were the one that Hodder and Stoughton said, we want to write this book.
Well, I'm speaking to you from my office in Oxford in the United Kingdom. And my day job here is teaching at a little seminary, training clergy for the Church of England. My title is Professor of Modern Anglicanism in the University of Oxford. So I work as a historian on Anglican themes and topics, especially the history of the Church of England and the Anglican Communion. And about a dozen years ago, 13 years ago, when Archbishop Justin Welby was announced, I wrote a rapid biography of his path to Canterbury. It's called Archbishop Justin Welby, Risk Taker and Reconciler. And that was a really enjoyable research project. We thought with the publisher, well, why not try to attempt the same a second time? A bit of a mad scheme, writing a biography in 2 months, but it's proved very stimulating and great fun.
Well, you're slower than the AIs, I saw, but still quite an impressive undertaking. I mean, how do you organize a project like that?
Well, Sarah was announced as the new Archbishop on the 3rd of October. So that was the day the research began. And the first draft had to be delivered to the publisher by the 3rd of December. And then some more revisions and additions over the Christmas vacation and into the press in January in time for release in March. So I spent those 2 months diving straight into archives and as many parish records that I could find. I spoke with many of her colleagues and friends around the Church of England and back in her youth to try and build up a bit of a picture and then just write the narrative.
In the preface, you describe her as a trailblazer and a pioneer. What do you mean by this?
She's the first woman in the office. That marks her out. I mean, that's a very historic moment, to be the first woman. She's also the first to have such significant experience outside of the church before ordination. So when Justin Welby began, many people said he's an archbishop like no other because he had 12 or 13 years of experience in the oil industry and in big business. But Sarah has 20 years of experience in the National Health Service in England and the Department of Health and the Civil Service here. She was ordained at the age of 39, later than any Archbishop of Canterbury in history. Most of them, of course, are ordained in their 20s. Very unusual. And she's also the first to come through the Church of England's part-time theological training courses. The classic history of an archbishop is public school, the elite schools like Eton and Harrow, and then you go to Oxford or Cambridge, And then you go to a full-time theological college and you worked your way up the church's hierarchy. Sarah's completely different to that. She went to a polytechnic to train as a nurse, and then she did her theological training in an evening course, and now she finds herself as archbishop.
The section on her early life in the book is very interesting, suburban childhood in the London suburbs. And then it talks about how she had an evangelical conversion as a teenager and got involved in the Christian Union, which is a sister organization to InterVarsity Christian Fellowship here in the U.S. But one of the things I thought was interesting is she goes to London as a student. And, you know, then as now, London is a place that's full of lots of thriving, charismatic and conservative evangelical churches with lots of students. But instead, she chooses to get involved at St. Stephen's in South Lambeth. And you talk about how influential that congregation was on forming her as a leader. Can you share a little bit about that congregation and how that prepared her?
So London as a capital city is a place of great contrasts. From multimillionaires and great social deprivation. But the River Thames runs through London, of course. So you have the culture of north of the river and south of the river. And Sarah Mullally was very much formed south of the river. This tends to be the poorer part of London. It's not Westminster. It's not the seat of government. It's not the banking sector in the old city with many of the large evangelical churches. Lambeth is a poorer part of the capital. But it's where her polytechnic was based. As an 18-year-old, she went to the Polytechnic of the South Bank to take a degree in nursing, ages of 18 to 22. And her first year student accommodation was in a brutalist 1960s concrete tower block. And nearby was this little evangelical church. It was a very lively congregation. It was socially mixed, racially mixed, a large number of people from the Caribbean and from West Africa as part of that church. It was informal in its expression. So they seldom had robes. They had a music group. They had Bibles in the pews. You have university-educated folk alongside those with very little formal education, mix of languages, mix of context, but quite a conservative theology at its heart. It was missional in its outreach to the local housing estates and strong on gospel proclamations, strong on Christian conversion as emphases. Not a congregation that she simply stayed in for her student years, as you might expect, and then moved somewhere else. She was actually part of St. Stephen's South Lambeth for the best part of 21 years, from 18 to 39, from teenage years up into middle age. So it has formed her and shaped her in fundamental ways, I think.
Now, you spoke a few moments ago about the significance of her career in nursing as a nurse administrator in the National Health Service. And I'm curious how you think that that experience has shaped her ministry within the church.
Remarkably, her new home at Lambeth Palace is only a few hundred yards from the hospital in which she trained, St. Thomas's Hospital in Lambeth, which was a school of nursing training set up by Florence Nightingale back in the 19th century. And to begin with, she walked the wards as a nurse and quite quickly was promoted through ward sister and then senior nurse and administrator in some of the worked all the way up to being an executive, part of the senior leadership team of a flagship hospital called the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, where she is an administrator in charge of thousands of nurses and seven-figure budgets, very significant influence, but then was headhunted by the government and taken to be the chief nursing officer for England. She had an office just opposite 10 Downing Street in the centre of London, where she's then moving amongst politicians and policy formers. And I think those years, those 20 years, have shaped the Archbishop of Canterbury in innumerable ways. Let me offer a couple. One way that she's been shaped by her nursing experience is her emphasis upon compassion for the person in front of you and equal treatment of whoever comes through the doors of the hospital and is in need. So the ministry of kindness and care and compassion, of course, they're Christian virtues. Kindness is one of the fruit of the Spirit, we're told in the New Testament. But they're also nursing virtues, and they're ones that have shaped Sarah, I think, in terms of her personal character. She has washed the feet of probably literally thousands of people in her nursing ministry, and she adopts that as a metaphor for what it means to be a Christian leader, of compassion and care for the people that you meet and servant-hearted leadership. That's one significant way. I think another significant way is that it has given her administrative skills in how to lead a very large organization. So of the two great British institutions, the Church of England and the National Health Service, are two of the most complex organizations in this country. And she's been near the top of the National Health Service and now also the Church of England. A very proficient administrator, used to handling big budgets, used to collaborating to make changes happen. But also, I think, as a civil servant, used to not revealing herself necessarily. If you are in Whitehall working alongside the government, there will be policy statements that you will back up. You are very careful about your public pronouncements. And she's brought that into her ministry as a bishop and archbishop as well. She's very careful with the words that she uses. And I think she learnt that as a senior nurse.
I think you said at one point that she remarked that they will put on my tombstone, she ran a good meeting. I don't know that's what will go on Justin Welby's tombstone, but certainly that's something she learned to do.
I love that expression of hers. When I die, they'll say, I ran a good meeting. And it is a skill that you need as a senior Christian leader. Certainly Justin Welby as Archbishop 105 and Sarah Mullally as Archbishop 106 are very different personalities, but also with very different skill sets. One of Sarah's is calmness. Just last month in February 2026 at the General Synod of the Church of England, she was in her first role as president of the Synod and therefore gave her inaugural presidential address. And she said, as Archbishop, you can expect from me three things, which will be calmness, consistency, and compassion. But I think that's significant. Calmness, consistency, and compassion. Not necessarily big programs, not necessarily driving through force of personality, great schemes for the Anglican Communion, but just calm administration.
So, Andrew, I think you've probably read more of Archbishop Mullally's sermons than anyone else besides her. And so I'm curious, what themes stand out in her preaching and how do they express her theological vision?
One of the most rich and delightful sources for the biography was a set of sermon manuscripts which are held by the Cathedral Archive in Salisbury. Sarah Mullally was a canon of the cathedral for 2.5 years. And so reading through those, you have her monthly preaching to a normal congregation at a normal Sunday Eucharist, not the sermons you would get on YouTube that might be for great state events or great ceremonies, but just normal preaching to a normal cathedral congregation. And I think some very striking themes emerge from those sermons. Sarah is always drawn, or very often drawn, towards the gospel reading. She loves speaking about Jesus Christ, and she loves speaking about personal encounters with Jesus. So many of her sermons are those gospel narratives. A theme that she frequently draws is the fact that Jesus welcomes the outsider, the marginalized, the one who is rejected by the religious leaders and the theologians, as we see frequently in the Gospels. And Sarah will point to those instances as part of, again, the compassionate care and concern and welcome of Jesus Christ to those on the edges. That's something she sees in the Gospels, and it's something she wants Christians everywhere and Anglicans everywhere to be modeling in their churches. when you hear her preaching in other contexts, perhaps in other churches or cathedrals or at conferences, you'll notice that those are major themes she will reiterate again and again.
Well, as you said, these were themes that came up in her General Synod address, in the remarks that she made after the announcement of her selection. I mean, these clearly come from the heart of who she is and of her vision of the Christian gospel. I wanted to ask you about something that we've heard a fair amount about in the religious press over here, that there was a brief time in which she kept a blog, and in that blog, at one point, she described herself as pro-choice. And I thought that the way you gave some context to that statement really clarified it in a helpful way. And I'm curious if you would speak a little bit about it and what she might have meant when she said that.
Over the last few months, many critics have looked at it in particular, and her blog has been taken down since. The blog is a comment, really, on the American political scene back in 2012. A risky thing, she says, blogging, and perhaps a doubly risky thing, commenting on the politics of another nation across the Atlantic. But this was the time, you'll remember, of the Republican Party presidential primaries, the ones that Mitt Romney ultimately was successful in. And Rick Santorum was a candidate at the time. And there was a big profile in Time magazine of Rick Santorum. He is a conservative Roman Catholic who has spoken about moral questions, has spoken against abortion from a Christian point of view, and has disabled children himself, so speaks about that with real personal experience rather than just as a theory. And Sarah is struck by the Time profile of Santorum and therefore comments in her blog on these questions, and in particular supporting his call not to rush towards abortion. But then she reveals a bit about herself. Shall I read you the quotation?
Yeah, sure. I think it'd be helpful.
Sarah writes, "I would suspect that I would describe my approach to this issue as pro-choice rather than pro-life, although if it were a continuum, I would be somewhere along it moving towards pro-life when it relates to my choice and then enabling choice when it related to others." And then she adds a little dash, "if that makes any sense." So she's clearly thinking as she writes, wondering if what she's just expressed does make sense. She's sort of feeling towards a particular position. And she's made it very clear in the last couple of months that that was an unguarded statement on her blog. She wouldn't describe herself as pro-choice. The official position of the Church of England, principled opposition to abortion, but a recognition there might be circumstances, very limited circumstances, where there are no better alternatives. So she's now publicly reaffirming the Church of England's stated position. And as I say, the blog has been taken down.
To bring up another kind of complicated, divisive moral issue, she also played an important role in the Living in Love and Faith process, which has led to permission for same-sex blessings of couples in the Church of England. And as a result of this, this has kind of been the thing that Anglican leaders, especially in the Global South, have brought up when they've said that they've rejected her leadership of the Anglican Communion. And I think it's helpful for people to understand, it's been a long process, Living in Love and Faith. Could you clarify kind of what her particular role is? And some people have described her as a supporter, an advocate of same-sex blessings or of same-sex marriage. Do you think that fairly describes her position in this matter or not?
The Living in Love and Faith process in the Church of England has been a long and complicated, painful and nuanced conversation. And I think certainly many of those nuances are lost in the reporting. As that reporting travels to other parts of the world, the complexities are perhaps missed. It's been a long conversation, going back at least to 2017, when the bishops of the Church of England brought a quite conservative policy to the General Synod And the General Synod refused to take note of it. In effect, they said, we don't like what you've brought. Think again. So Archbishop Welby initiated an expensive and major project with theologians and ethicists, practical theologians, New Testament scholars, medical scientists, to begin with a research project for 3 or 4 years from 2017. And Sarah was organizing one of the working streams for that in biological sciences. But then in 2020, round about the time of the COVID pandemic, we moved from the research phase to the implementation phase. And the bishops of the Church of England brought forward some specific proposals for the General Synod to debate. And Sarah was the figurehead of that on behalf of the bishops of the Church of England. She was the Bishop of London by that stage. And for 3 years or so, she headed up the process before it passed on to another bishop. And it has just concluded in 2026. The conversation will continue, but Living in Love and Faith has formally ended as a Church of England project. What are Sarah's own roles in that? She's been quite reticent, because she's been chairing the process, at revealing her personal theological sympathies. And she's on record as saying, I think it would be unhelpful if I did say where I stood on some of these issues. She will affirm the teaching historically of the Church of England. She'll do that publicly. She will affirm the canons of the Church of England and the doctrine of marriage. But in terms of the pastoral implications of what this means for same-sex couples who approach the church wanting pastoral care, wanting support, perhaps wanting God's blessing, the Church of England has settled temporarily in allowing the blessing of same-sex couples as part of perhaps intercessory prayers on a Sunday morning. There are no liturgies for special standalone services. So yes, we do have the blessing of couples, but in a very limited way. But we don't have yet same-sex marriages within the Church of England. If it would happen at all, it would be a very complex legal and theological process to get there. And Sarah has never supported same-sex marriages in church, though she has supported the blessing of those who've been married, perhaps in the town hall, who've then come to church not for a marriage, but for a blessing service. It's been very controversial. It's been very complicated. And in my book, I try to unravel some of the complexities of Sarah's own position.
So would it be fair to say that she makes a strong distinction between, say, theological teaching about marriage and pastoral presence in the lives of same-sex couples?
I interpret her as saying that what the Church of England has offered in the prayers of love and faith, or what the House of Bishops have sought to bring to the church and commended for use, is a pastoral provision for a couple who come to you in need and desire to grow closer to God. So going back to her principle of welcoming in the outsider and Jesus' concern and compassion for the marginalised, what does that look like in the Church of England? She hasn't anywhere argued for the doctrine of marriage to change, and that's laid down in our canons, Canon B30, as between a man and a woman for life. That's the doctrine of the Church of England. But she has argued for pastoral provision in the form of these liturgies. And that's been far too little for some in the Church of England, and far too much for others.
Preacher, are you looking for new resources to make preaching each week a little easier and, dare I say it, maybe even fun? Well, you can join Episcopal priests Father Jacob Smith and Father Aaron Zimmerman for the Same Old Song podcast. Same Old Song. Each week, they break down the lectionary texts for the coming Sunday with gospel insight, a few appropriate cultural references, sometimes slightly inappropriate, and a heart for the sufferer in the pew and the pulpit, all in half an hour. Check out Same Old Song wherever you get your podcasts, or check out the link in the show notes. isolation, disconnection from peers, burnout. Many Christian leaders know how this feels. At The Living Church, we realized a long time ago that we weren't just here to be a magazine or a podcast, but a catalyst for connection. Through digital and in-person opportunities, we love creating a sanctuary for the shepherds, cultivating fellowship, continuity, and stability so that leaders can thrive and local churches can too. So how do we do this? Through lots of pastoral emails and phone calls, actually, with friends and subscribers like you, but also in public ways, webinars, conferences, our online covenant journal, teaching and preaching resources, and the Living Church podcast. We're called to encourage those on the front lines of parish ministry. So when you donate to The Living Church, you are funding this lifeline for connection and renewal. Whether it's $5, $50, or $5,000, your gift will not only continue the products and programs that you're enjoying right now, it will encourage and equip another leader like you. Donate to The Living Church today. You can go to livingchurch.org and click donate, or check out the link that's always in the show notes.
The Church of England has faced a series of crises around safeguarding. This is part of what led to Archbishop Welby stepping down early. And some people have described Archbishop Mullally as a safe pair of hands on this very difficult issue. Do you agree with that analysis?
The Church of England has, like many denominations around the world and many provinces in the Anglican Communion, found itself in deep difficulties over the mishandling of safeguarding cases, both recently and historic ones which have been coming to light in the last few years. Many things, I think, have improved. And although Justin Welby resigned over the question in 2024, he did drive forward many practical changes on the ground. I think if you asked most local parish churches how safeguarding is happening in their worshipping communities, they're very, very strong. Lots of good practice multiplying across the country. One of the concerns, though, is how bishops have handled allegations. My reading is that Sarah herself has strongly improved safeguarding operations in the Diocese of London. She's tackled many of the questions. She's brought new investment and new resources and personnel. Quite a lot of those have been difficult cases, only a little bit of which ends up in the public domain. But it's nonetheless also true that many have been highly critical of her for what they would call mishandling of some of those cases. And there have been some scandals in the Diocese of London, which have been very high profile. She has said she welcomes the scrutiny and that all bishops and archbishops and leaders in the church should be scrutinized for their approach and handling of safeguarding questions. So she welcomes the light that is being shone upon the church and upon her own work within the church. My reading of it, though, is that, yes, she has done reasonably well in a very difficult situation.
Looking at her ministry in the Diocese of London, and even earlier, I think, when she was a suffragan in Exeter Diocese, she's gone out of her way, you've written, to build trust with people who have strong theological disagreements with her, who are opponents of the ordination of women. And she talks a lot about being committed to mutual flourishing. Can you say a little more about this and the role that you think it might play in her ministry as Archbishop of Canterbury?
One of the unusual things about the Church of England is that in our conversations about men and women in ministry and the ordination of women as deacons and priests and bishops, which was a 20 or 30 year process, but also a 100 year conversation, one of the unusual things about the Church of England has been its desire to keep the minority viewpoint within the church. In other words, perhaps traditional Catholics who, for sacramental reasons, might not be happy to accept women as bishops and priests. The Church of England has said, we want you in the church. Or perhaps it's the complementarian evangelicals who for reasons of authority in preaching have parallel, though different, concerns. And the Church of England has corporately said, we want all these Anglicans within the church. We think they are faithful Anglicans, even though we disagree strongly amongst ourselves, and we want everybody to flourish. Hence this phrase, mutual flourishing. When you are ordained in the Church of England today, and when you take on high episcopal office, you must agree that you support mutual flourishing. That means if you are a traditionalist, that you support women in their ministries and you want them to flourish, even though you might not sit under them yourself. And if you are an egalitarian in your view, that you also want the traditionalists and the conservatives to flourish. Justin Welby spoke a lot into this, and Sarah Mullally herself has been a vocal defender of that settlement. It's a very fragile settlement in the Church of England at the moment. It's being rethought because of its inherent complexities and perhaps contradictions. But Sarah has said this is the stated will of the church for the moment. She will strongly back it. And that means everywhere she goes, she has worked really quite closely and well with traditional Catholics and complementarian evangelicals who may not celebrate the fact that we have women bishops in the Church of England. But she's built bridges. And rather than asking them the question, how can you make my ministry flourish? She always asks the question the other way around. What can I do as bishop or archbishop to make your ministry flourish? This is a distinctive thing she brings to the church, and I think she brings to the Anglican Communion. And time will tell over the next 5 or 6 years that how this might apply not just to local concerns here in England, but also to some of the international tensions we're experiencing.
So speaking of those tensions, the Anglican Communion, to be generous, is in a bit of a mess at the moment. And one thing that's striking about Archbishop Mullally is that, certainly in contrast to her predecessor, she has very limited international experience. I mean, you talk about how she had some engagement with London's diocesan link with the Anglican Church in Mozambique, and she traveled a little bit in the Episcopal Church in the U.S. But I'm curious about how much of a priority you think Anglican Communion work will have for her. Do you have a sense in which she might intend to influence the Communion? How much interest does she bring for the international, global church dimension of this calling?
She certainly has experience of the Anglican world. Trips to Zimbabwe, trips to Mozambique and Angola, Brazil. But she has much less experience than, for example, Justin Welby did when he began. He, of course, was practically appointed as archbishop because of his international connections. He'd spent many years in Nigeria working in reconciliation ministry and was well known in America and in Nigeria, provinces which you don't often hear mentioned, perhaps in friendly terms in the same sentence. Sarah has far less experience. I think it will be on her heart. I think they probably, administratively, it will take much less of her time in investment than Justin Welby gave to it. He has been criticised strongly in the Church of England for the number of weeks of the year he would spend travelling outside of the country, and perhaps a third of his time as Archbishop, which left English Anglicans saying, what about English concerns? You know, there are serious questions for our church here that need some attention. I think we'll see Sarah probably travelling less frequently. I think we'll also see her working and seeking to work deliberately, collaboratively with the other primates of the Anglican Communion. You'll know that the Nairobi-Cairo proposals are coming to the Anglican Consultative Council in a few months' time, in June and July, meeting in Belfast. So the Nairobi-Cairo proposals, which have been developed by IASCUFO, the Inter-Anglican Standing Commission on Unity, Faith and Order, which is like the ecclesiological think tank for the Anglican Communion. We are bringing proposals to the Anglican Consultative Council in Belfast in June and July. And one of the significant proposals is that the leadership of the Anglican Communion is diversified, not just the Archbishop of Canterbury representing the communion at every ecumenical event or every inauguration of a new province, but many leaders in the communion working together, especially the primates, working more as a team. And Sarah, I think, will be much more deliberately collaborative in her ministry in this new style that she will bring.
So the Nairobi Cairo proposals may be the sort of vision for the Archbishop of Canterbury that's more congenial to her altogether because of her leadership style.
Well, we will wait and see what her judgment is when the Anglican Consultative Council meets. But I think you're right. I think we might see several things working in harmony together, which is a natural desire in the Church of England to change the working relationship of the Archbishop of Canterbury, and a natural desire in the Anglican Communion to change that working relationship. We're all pushing in the same direction.
So you talked about concerns from within the Church of England about Archbishop Welby perhaps being too engaged in Anglican Communion affairs. Part of this also is that a significant role for the Archbishop of Canterbury, maybe not as much as generations ago, but a significant role remains addressing the British people on important social questions, speaking out in times of public crisis. And Archbishop Mullally has had a little bit of experience of this as the Bishop of London, you know, one of the church's largest see. And I'm curious what you make of her public voice on public questions thus far. Do you feel that she's up to the task of being the public voice of the church in a significant way?
As much as there are frequent commentators in the news saying the Church of England is an irrelevance now in modern Britain, actually the words of the Archbishop of Canterbury do carry weight. People notice, and politicians and governments notice as well. Of course, we have over 20 bishops and archbishops in the House of Lords, our upper chamber in Parliament. They're there ex officio because of their office. And she's already spent 8 years in the House of Lords, frequently speaking on matters of social and political and national concern as the Bishop of London. I anticipate her continuing to do that as Archbishop of Canterbury. And one of the themes that she reiterates to the Lords, the peers, as they scrutinise government legislation, is the value of every human being. On Christian principles, she'll talk about imago Dei, every human being made in the image of God and therefore deeply, deeply valued and treasured. When we are thinking about our refugee and migrant crisis and whether we should simply ship people off to another country when they stand on British shores, well, she would say that's a theological question because it relates to the humanity of the people in front of us. When it comes to questions over immigration riots, when it comes to domestic abuse, she will speak into those questions. There is a major debate happening within the UK at the moment on assisted suicide or assisted dying. And she has been perhaps the most vocal opponent in the House of Lords of the proposals. And she's an opponent of them for many practical reasons to do with coercion, but also on the basis of the value of every human being. And therefore, we need to be investing in care, not a sort of state-endorsed deaths that might be the future position of the National Health Service. She speaks frequently on these questions. Of course, they get governments and politicians agitated because they are major controversial questions. She doesn't keep out of them. In fact, she says quite the opposite. She will say, read the Gospels and you will see that Christians ought to be involved in political questions. Not party political, not voting for one particular side, but definitely political in the sense of engaged in national debate and policy formation. She sees that as a Christian duty and therefore one of her roles as the Archbishop of Canterbury.
And I suppose these questions like assisted suicide, domestic violence, these are areas in which the voice of the church is still highly respected in Britain. And so she's talking about things where people are ready to listen to a religious contribution to those debates.
Many of the other faith leaders in Britain, outside of the Christian churches, welcome the fact that we have bishops in the House of Lords, because they will say there are people who are speaking on theological and religious principles into our legislature, not just on secular principles. So yes, I think those voices are still very important. Though, of course, if the bishops say things about policy with which you disagree, well, then you think they should be quiet and should be removed from Parliament.
Of course.
It was ever thus.
You wrote a terrific column in the Church Times, and one of the things that you said there has really intrigued me. You said that she will have a relatively short tenure as bishop because of her age. But you said that probably means that she doesn't need to be in a hurry. That's a bit of a paradox. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sarah Mullally's legacy in Anglican global history has already been made, because she is the first ever woman in the history of the church for 1400 years to be appointed to this high office, to the seat of Augustine. That is a remarkable thing, and when the history books are written, they will look back to that fact. And there's almost nothing that Sarah can do over the next 6 years which will be greater than that thing in terms of her impact upon the church and the leadership of the church and diversifying the face of the church. That's a huge moment historically. Now, of course, when Justin Welby came in as Archbishop, he had perhaps 12 or 13 years ahead of him before retirement, and he had a very busy, energetic program of transformation, almost from top to bottom in church life in England and around the Anglican Communion. Lots of new ideas, lots of new initiatives at quite a considerable pace that I think left him personally exhausted as an individual, but it also left the church exhausted. Sarah has rather said, back to her three C's, calm, consistent, and compassionate. She won't be bringing major new initiatives. She won't be bringing groundbreaking policy formation. Actually, I think many in the Church of England have breathed a sigh of relief when they heard that, because local parishes say, well, okay, we can just have some time getting on with the normal work of following Jesus Christ and witnessing to him in our communities without all the turmoil of the church. Of course, it will continue to happen, those debates are around Sarah, but I don't think she will be driving them. And that's what I mean by not needing to be in a hurry. She could, as I think I perhaps said in that column in the Church Times, she could spend 6 years sitting in the garden of Lambeth Palace on a sun lounger, and her legacy for the church will still be that she is the first female Archbishop of Canterbury in 1400 years. And therefore, she doesn't need to rush. She doesn't need to push. She doesn't need to hurry.
Fascinating. Well, thank you so much, Andrew. I've been speaking today with Professor Andrew Atherston, Professor of Modern Anglicanism at the University of Oxford and Tutorial Fellow and Latimer Research Fellow at Wycliffe Hall. Andrew's the author of many books, including the biography of Justin Welby that he mentioned. He's also just published the definitive biography of Archbishop Sarah Mullally. You can find it wherever good books are sold. Andrew, thank you for being with us on the Living Church podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for the conversation.
Thanks for tuning into the Living Church podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. Learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. In 2 weeks, how might your prayer life affect your leadership? The Reverend John Sundara joins us to share ministry stories and explore the relationship between private prayer practices and patterns of institutional health. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.